arrival was almost unspeakable.
We are all evil in some form or another.
I'm not guilty.
The dead won't bother you. It's the living you gotta worry about.
If I couldn't keep them there with me whole, at least I felt that I could keep their skeletons.
Hello, and welcome to the Bad Taste Crime Podcast. I'm Vicky.
And I'm Janelle.
We back again. Some more murder.
Yes.
Crimes. Mysteries. And
fire.
Arson. All the
science.
Crime. All the crime. Yeah. Back
just
again.
Things we've done.
Yeah, right.
Not it, done personally, but like covered. Oh,
covered.
God.
Yes. Oh, no. No.
No, I'm just.
Allegedly.
I'm
allegedly.
Just oh, God. Oh, no. Now they know.
If this is your first time listening, a special hello to you. We're just going to cut with the riff.
And if you're a returning listener. Oh, God. Also, hello to you as well.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that'll avoid all the angry text messages. Yeah. We're just going to jump right into it, I think. Yeah. How do you feel about that? Cool
with
that?
I feel great about it.
All right. Let's head over to the newsroom.
We both had a lot of nut-based snacks, and we're ready. Just yeah. ready to go. The energy yeah. is high.
We're trying to push through to nap time, so.
I mean, no nap time for me, but, you know.
Oh, straight up. I'm going to take the longest nap ever.
I am going to my studio.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
MFA shows, am I right?
Oh, God. Oh, God. All right. This week, our news comes from Texas, unfortunately.
Yeah, pretty shitty place to be right now.
Wichita Falls. Mm-hmm. So early in the morning, July 18th, Melvin Earl Young was
like a country singer name.
Yeah, was arrested by police for burglary. What was he burglaring, you ask? It was a McBride Steakhouse.
Okay, not familiar.
Me neither, but.
Sounds
it's
official.
A steakhouse, yeah. When they got there, the front door was locked, but they heard some, or I'm sorry, the front door was unlocked and they heard some noise in the kitchen. So they went back to see what it was, found Melvin. They said he was wearing black latex gloves and standing at a refrigerator.
Oh, God. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And he had an ID on him that identified him as Melvin Young. And then when they arrested him and searched him, they said that there were several strip steaks and one ribeye slab in the backpack, and three fillets were on a table. And they also found several bottles of liquor in a plastic bag, and that the liquor closet had been broken into.
Sounds like he's ready for a barbecue.
Steak and booze,
mm-hmm.
right? Melvin Young has been convicted of theft in the past in 1986. Mm-hmm. And so he was arrested and has a bond set and is awaiting trial. But, yep, went in to steal some steak and booze.
Classic combo.
Classic combo.
Crime and cooking.
Let's move on to Netflix and Kill. This week is a Max and Kill.
I'll never get used to that.
I'm sorry.
Name.
No.
I'll never
I'm sorry.
Get used to that name.
Let me rewind. I have Peacock now.
Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to preface this by saying I haven't watched this yet, but okay. I still want to talk about it because there's some implications in here that are a little tricky. Mm-hmm. So the documentary is called Casey Anthony, Where the Truth Lies.
You haven't seen it yet?
I have not seen it yet. Have you seen it?
Interesting. Uh-huh.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to talk about this because I think unless you've been living under a rock, you probably know who Casey Anthony is. This documentary particularly provides a space for her.
Eloquent words you're using here.
Yes, yes. Provides a space for Casey Anthony to come on and tell her side of the story.
Because the court case didn't do that enough.
Yes. So if you don't remember, she was in her 20s, living in Florida, was accused of killing her two-year-old daughter, Kaylee. She's originally reported missing, and there were allegations that Casey Anthony was covering the whole thing up. She was charged with first-degree murder, and then found not guilty. She was acquitted. Yeah. So this is very, very controversial. Mm-hmm. They did find Kaylee's body eventually in a wooded area near the home. But the trial was kind of controversial. It happened in early 2000. You know, it's very, I would say this verdict is up there with like OJ Simpson, where it's like,
which is why they're best friends.
Did you know that? Yeah. Yes, I did.
In case you guys didn't know that, look it up. There, BFFs.
Lots of
partners in crime, if you will.
Yeah, God.
Sorry.
Lots of strange things. But I always think that it's really interesting when something like this happens. I'm actually kind of surprised OJ hasn't done a fucking documentary himself.
I'm waiting for a joint podcast to come out from those two. Right. They both live in Florida.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although OJ did write the book, If I Did It, remember that?
Yeah, and the podcast would be something to that effect. Yikes.
Right.
If we did it.
Right, yeah. So it's an interesting thing when something like this comes out, because you always have to take it with a grain of salt. You know, obviously there's a lot of public opinion surrounding the Casey Anthony case, or the Kaylee Anthony case, as it would be, should be more rightly called.
Yes, because
you know, it's a
dead child.
Yeah, and I think she disappears too much in this case in particular, because it's all about Casey Anthony. But thoughts, since you have seen it and I have not.
There was a very uncomfortable moments throughout the entire thing. Lots of close-ups of her face.
Yeah.
A couple moments where they tried to do some edging on gotchas with her, like, but why didn't you... What happened with the lying of your being, you know, working at Disney still?
And yeah.
If it was an accident, why didn't you tell anyone?
You know,
like asking those questions.
Yeah.
It did seem like they were trying to get her to like say the incorrect thing, but she's been repeating the same stuff over and over and over and over again. It's not going to happen. She's not going to like accidentally slip up. You know, right. Off camera, but mic's still on.
Yeah. No jinx moment.
No jinx moments. Yeah. No Curious Case of Natalia Grace moments.
Yeah, right.
But it was really uncomfortable. I like to do this thing where I'm, you know, if I'm on a vacation or home on a Sunday by myself or whatever, I'll put on something and then like fall asleep to it and then come back to it. That's what I did during this because I was just like, I can't.
Yeah.
But it is interesting, but very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
If you like to be uncomfortable.
I'm looking forward to it.
Some people like to be uncomfortable.
I love being uncomfortable.
Definitely uncomfortable.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to watching it just because, you know, I think these kinds of things are important as a, almost like a documentary tool, for lack of a better term. Like, for having this on file, on the record.
Yeah. Definitely, like, made me feel more leaning towards, like, watching this and, like, going back and thinking about the case, I definitely feel like she did something neglectful that caused her daughter to die. Maybe not directly murder her, but neglected her enough that she died from something. And she was just like, oh, my God, I'm going to go to jail. And then covered it up. Like, that definitely solidifies that kind of storyline for me, watching this and then kind of thinking about it more.
Yeah. And the way, at least from the trailers, the way that they filmed it reminded me a lot of the Amanda Knox documentary, where it, again, is her telling her story after an acquittal. But I have always felt with the Amanda Knox story that she was innocent. Like, I have always felt that, you know, and with Casey Anthony, I don't necessarily feel that way. So, like,
no, I feel like she, like, didn't feed her kid, or, like, the kid. She told her kid to fuck off, and like something happened, like, you know, where that kind of situation.
Yeah.
Where it was extreme neglect.
Yeah. I think it's worth saying these are all our opinions,
yes,
by the way.
Almost 100%. This entire podcast is just opinions and barely
facts. In case this ever comes up in a court case when we're getting sued. But
like, oh, this is not very, the research, like, fuck off. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is loosely researched, mostly a joke.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
But I mean, I think it's worth a watch again, just for the sheer posterity of it.
Yeah.
I guess.
Or if you want to put yourself to sleep.
I'll watch this when I go to take a nap later. So in case you're interested, that is on Peacock. It is called Casey Anthony, Where the Truth Lies. Also, Interesting title. Truth, Lies. Whoa, deep. All right. This is that part of the show where we say content may not be appropriate for all listeners. This week we're talking about murder. I've said that for the last like four episodes, but.
Yeah. I mean, mine's a plot twist again. So like, am I talking about murder?
Yeah.
I don't even know what I'm talking about anymore.
I feel like mine is a very old timey story that you're going to be very into.
I love an old timey story.
You're going to be into this.
I love, put me in another place in time. Take me out of this modern era, please.
So
with my modern problems.
This one, the next couple episodes, you'll be in heaven then.
I love it.
So this week we're talking about Murder for Hire.
And then I do all the modern stuff too. Oh my God.
Yeah, that's wild. Who are we? We're talking about Murder for Hire. It's more common than you would assume.
Yeah.
People like to try to pay people to murder other people.
Mm-hmm. Or do anything, really.
Yeah.
I feel like there is yet to be a task rabbit for murder, but it's coming.
A task rabbit for murder. This, anytime I talk about Murder for Hire, I always think of that guy that made the website where you could, it was like a Murder for Hire website.
Hitman. Yeah.
And Hire Hitman. Yeah, HireHitman.com. And it was like very obviously
a joke. But people are so fucking stupid. They thought it was for real.
Yeah. So we started working with the FBI.
If it's on the regular internet, it's not real.
No.
You have to go to the dark web for that.
Yeah.
Duh.
Get that Tor browser. Anyway.
VPNs.
Yeah. So we are going to visit the state of South Carolina in the
tough one.
Early 1900s.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Let's do this.
Are you ready?
I'm ready for some racism. Let's do it.
So the story begins with a man named David Timmerman. Now, Timmerman lived in Edgefield County and was a prominent businessman in the area. He owned, he was incredibly wealthy, owned like a filling station. They often call it the store, but these things were kind of one and the same. They were like convenience stores and gas stations. Mm-hmm. It also appears that he had some sort of farm, as so many people, they had something and lived on a farm.
It was not common to not have.
Yeah, right. Because he definitely had some farm animals. Mm-hmm. One day in September 1940, one of Timmerman's mules wandered onto some land that belonged to J. Wallace Logue. Mm-hmm. Now, Logue was a World War I vet who was married to Sue Logue, and they lived on the farm property next door to Timmerman. Okay, so back to the mule. So, the mule, it wanders onto some land that belongs to Logue. While it was there, the mule kicked one of Logue's calves to death.
I mean, that would just take one blow, really. Mules are very strong.
Yes, and calves are not.
Our babies.
They're babies. Baby cows.
Barely a cow.
Yeah, so he wandered on, beat the shit out of this beat the shit out of this calf. Now, obviously, Logue was not super thrilled about this.
Right.
And he requested that Timmerman pay $20 to replace the calf.
Yeah, that sounds logical.
To which he agreed. He was like, cool, yeah. I get it.
Let me get that mule out of here and we'll get you a new calf.
Yeah. So Logue went to the filling station to collect his money. But by the time he got there, he had decided, no. Actually, you need to give me $40.
Price of calves are going up now.
Doubled the price. Timmerman was like, that's not what we agree on. I'm not paying that.
Yeah.
And
I was just done, like, here's your 20. Don't ever talk to me again.
Right. Which $20 was like a lot.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he refused to pay.
I thought you were going to be like, he wanted $20 and to murder that mule.
Yeah, right. Hire somebody to murder the mule.
I want you to kill that mule in front of me.
Kill that ass.
Exactly.
So he refused to pay, and this caused a huge altercation.
Southern men and their fucking pride.
No, fuck you. No, fuck you. Exactly. And then just and rabble, then rabble.
Hatfield McCoy all the live long day. It's a deep cut reference.
Yeah. Look, yeah. So Logue grabbed an axe.
Okay.
And started attacking Timmerman.
Wow. Not even, see, like, this is where you need to, like, be like, yeah, fuck you, and then sneak onto his property and steal his animals instead.
Or kill the mule.
Yeah, kill the mule.
Retaliation,
axe the
yo.
Mule.
Axe the mule. In the midst of this fight, somehow, Timmerman grabbed a gun.
I mean, somehow.
I mean, I'm sure there were just guns
everywhere.
Laying around. Yeah.
Every nook and cranny.
Yeah. Grabs this gun, shoots Logue twice, kills him.
Well then, okay.
Yeah. Timmerman, who of course was injured himself.
I was going to be like murder for hire from the grave.
Yeah. Yeah. This is why I love this story, because it's like two murders in one, yeah. Right? So Timmerman was also injured. He drove to the sheriff's office to report the killing himself and like turn himself in.
Okay. Well, that's
respect.
An honorable thing to do.
Respect. Yeah.
Maybe not over what happened really, but.
Yeah, but if you're getting attacked by a guy with an axe, mm-hmm. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
So Timmerman was arrested and charged with the murder after a short investigation. It was pretty straightforward. There were witnesses, et cetera, yeah. et cetera. Now, at this point, there's three other people that enter the picture. There's going to be a kind of a lot of names, so I'm going to try to keep everybody straight.
Is it familial?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So first was Logue's widow, Sue Logue, we talked about a little bit ago, her brother-in-law, George Logue, and their nephew, Joe Frank. Okay.
Most southern names.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Joe Frank was pretty much raised in his like teenage years by Sue and George after his mom died when he was 16. And they pretty much raised him after that. He was also a police officer in Spartanburg, South Carolina. So after Timmerman is arrested, awaiting trial, Sue and George invite Joe Frank over multiple times, and most of these meetings consisted of Sue and George. Excuse me.
That's their ship name. We've shipped them as Jew.
Yeah. Sue and George proclaiming they would avenge Logue's death, with Joe later reporting he heard Sue say, quote, "I will kill David Timmerman or see that he is killed." So this is very Hatfield and McCoy.
It is just like, yeah. Eye for an eye for an eye, yeah. for an eye for and an eye.
I don't know that I included this in my research or not, but there are reports that prior to this incident with the mule and the calf and everything, like there was a long running feud between these two families and this property.
It's crazy because like in the South, it's like one or two ways. You either fucking hate each other and you want each other dead, or you're like, we're family.
I would die for that man.
In the holler together.
The holler.
You know?
Yeah. 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 So Timmerman went to trial March 1941 and, of course, presented self-defense as, like, his primary defense for the murder. And
so did you ever think maybe your husband was an asshole?
Yeah, right? Maybe. No. Mm-hmm. So he was acquitted of the crime. They were like, oh, yeah, totally self-defense.
Yeah, especially this is the South. Yeah.
Yeah. Obviously. The verdict came back in, like, a couple hours. It was very quick trial.
Obviously.
It was reported by witnesses who had attended the trial that Sue was heard claiming at that time that she would avenge her husband's death after the verdict came down.
Oh, Sue, you're fucking up.
Yeah, right. In the months after the court case was resolved, Sue, George, and Joe Frank began visiting a man named Fred Dorn. Now, Dorn was a sharecropper on the Logue's farm, and the group had asked if maybe he'd be willing to kill David Timmerman for them. So just a few weeks after that, one of Timmerman's farmhands wound up dead, and it wasn't like...
I'm sorry, what?
Yeah. It wasn't a crime that was like reported or prosecuted or investigated or anything, but it's suspected that George and Dorn were involved as like a warning. Okay. Yeah. Now, by July 1941, Sue and George decided that they pretty much had the crew assembled between the two of them and Joe Frank. That was good enough. So they actually went to Joe Frank and asked him to carry out the killing. Mm. Sue gave Joe Frank $500 to kill Timmerman. And he was, like, not really on board with this originally.
Mm-hmm.
But after Sue threatened the lives of his mother and wife, he was like, okay, I'll do it.
Jesus. Sue
yeah, this woman's wild.
Bitch.
She's wild.
She's going to have to hire another person to go out and kill the hired person to go out and kill the other person.
It's just going
to
be a domino effect of murder. So Joe Frank began his part of the plan, which meant finding somebody else that would help him kill Timmerman. So he approached a man named Clarence Bagwell, who was sort of like this known seedier character in Spartanburg. He had a past. Like, he was like... If you want something done, you go to Clarence. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Joe Frank asked if maybe Bagwell would kill Timmerman, to which Bagwell said, "You're going to have to pay me $500. And so after all of the monetary transactions, the two were ready by September 1941 after Joe Frank purchased a weapon from a pawn
middle
shop.
Of fucking World War II. You're concerned about this bullshit.
Yes. That fucking mule.
Get a hobby, bitch.
He killed the uncle.
Why don't you start riveting some shit, okay? Yeah, like, right. Goddamn.
But he killed my uncle. Even though he was being attacked by an axe, that doesn't matter. Right. Yeah, that's true. This is right smack dab in the middle of World War II. Anyway, so they got this weapon from a pawn shop, and then Joe Frank and Bagwell went to Timmerman's shop to, as they say, case the joint. Mm-hmm. They came back around 7 p.m. the same evening and asked for Bagwell, went into the shop while Joe Frank waited in the car. He approached the counter and asked for something, either cigarettes, gum, like something that was behind the counter. And when Timmerman turned around to retrieve the item, Bagwell shot him 4 to 5 times with a .38 caliber revolver.
Do it.
Yeah. Bagwell then fled, hopping in the car with Joe Frank and speeding away. And then Timmerman was discovered by his wife, who alerted police. Now, it seems that the initial investigation didn't really provide any leads, and they offered a cash reward with any information about the crime. Now, remember, this is the 1940s, so like investigative techniques were not exactly up to snuff.
You gotta force them to either confess, get a fingerprint, or an eyewitness.
Yeah,
that's it.
Pretty much. So there was a point just about a month after the murders when police mistakenly arrested two men from Fort Smith, Arkansas.
A what?
Yeah. Jesse L. James and Jimmy Kitchen.
Oh, Jimmy Kitchen.
Yes. This is where things get a little hairy. Okay. So these two guys get arrested. They are transported to Edgefield County by Sheriff Wad Allen.
Wad?
Yes.
Wad.
Wad.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
So glad I didn't grow up in the South.
Yeah. I know, me too. For more reason than one. Sheriff Allen happened to be the cousin of Sue and George.
Big connections here.
So he arrests these two guys, takes them up to Edgefield County, gives no reason as to why they're suspects or why they were arrested, and ends up charging Jesse L. James with murder.
Yeah, that's real big thing they do in the South.
Wild.
Well, I mean, they do it most. It would be a black person that they would be like,
mm-hmm. Right. Right.
They did it.
Yeah.
And then done.
Just wild. So James is now sitting in a cell, pretty much waiting for whatever was going to come next. Our friend Clarence Bagwell got into a bit of an argument with his girlfriend. And
are we getting some beans spilled?
They're saying in a drunken stupor. Yeah. At some point, he had divulged that he was actually responsible for Timmerman's murder. And
pillow
so the
talk, baby.
Yeah.
Every time.
I murdered that guy.
Tell me more, honey. Taking notes under the pillow.
Yeah, right. So she got so mad during this argument that she was like, you know what? Fuck you. Went to the police station and was like, oh, by the way, my boyfriend is responsible for Timmerman's murder.
There you go. Bitch. Mic drop. Yeah. Go to jail.
So they go off. They arrest Bagwell. And then Timmerman's widow, who had like, she was there when they cased the joint earlier in the day. So she was able to, she got called into the police station, was able to identify Bagwell as one of the guys who had been there earlier in the day. So she made the positive identification. After that, Bagwell pretty much confessed to everything, telling police how he had been hired by Joe Frank to carry out Timmerman's murder. Authorities then went off, arrested Joe Frank, who denied any part of the murder. I didn't have anything to do with this. And then after all of they're arresting all of these other suspects, right? Now they have these new, seemingly more likely people responsible and in custody. Police were finally able to release Jesse James and Jimmy Kitchen, and the two were fully exonerated. Yeah, before they even went to trial, which I'm like, good, because that could have, if it was post-trial, gone so much worse. On his attorney's advice, Joe Frank opted to confess to his part in the crime and implicated Sue and George in the process. So now police knew they were looking for two more people to add as accessories to the murder. So remember Sheriff Allen?
Yeah.
The cousin. Mm-hmm. Well, he and Sheriff William Clark went to the Logue's farm to arrest Sue and George. Now, Sheriff Allen had gone unarmed while Sheriff Clark was armed.
Okay.
When the two arrived and entered the house, George and Fred Dorn, who was the first guy who had been sort of hired to kill Timmerman, started shooting at the officers in an intense gun battle. Sheriff Allen, the cousin, was killed in the gunfire. And Sheriff Clark was able to shoot back, hitting George and killing Fred Dorn. Sheriff Clark had himself been hit and rushed to the hospital, and then he died 2 days later. So Jesus, both sheriffs.
Christ.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know. It gets wild. Oh, don't worry. It gets wilder. The community was like super upset that these two police officers had been killed as a result of the shootout and did what old timey folks do best. Formed a lynch mob.
Woohoo!
And they went to the Logue's farm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are you... This is about to take a weird turn.
Okay.
Are you familiar with Strom Thurmond?
I am. Yeah. Unfortunately, yeah.
Okay. So for those of you who are not, let me give you the highlights.
Okay. This is taking a weird turn.
It is taking a weird turn. He was a U.S. Senator from South Carolina from 1954 to 2003, which is crazy.
Like, stop. Yeah. Time limits anyone? Hello.
Yeah, right. he was governor of South Carolina from 1947 to 1951. He was actually a Democrat until 1964 when he switched parties. He was extremely heavily opposed to civil rights legislation, supported racial segregation, but continuously claimed to not be racist.
No. See,
it's like not racism.
People need like people.
Yeah, it's not racism, though. He also has the record for the longest speaking filibuster ever by a lone senator.
That's what I remember the most.
At 24 hours and 18 minutes when he spoke in opposition to the Civil Rights Act of 1957.
Like, bro.
I know.
Are you for fucking real?
Yeah. So that's Strom Thurmond. I bet you did not expect him to make a cameo in this story.
Cut it out, Strom.
Yeah. So after the lynch mob formed, Strom Thurmond, who at this point in the 40s was like a local judge in the area, he went to the farm to try to like diffuse the situation because...
That's not crossing the fucking line at all.
Well...
Judge.
Not only was he a judge... But Thurmond had been having an affair with Sue Logue.
Oh, I thought you were going to be like distant cousin. I'm like, fucking, of course.
Nah, just fucking.
Just fucking. Well, I mean, could still be a cousin.
Yeah, true. So he convinces his mob to let him through to like go negotiate with the Logues. And he was able to talk Sue and George into surrendering to police. Wild. So Sue, George, and Bagwell all went to trial in January 1942. The trial took 3 days, and the jury deliberated for 2 hours before finding all three of them guilty and sentencing them to death. At this point, they are being charged with, like, murder in addition to the accessory because of the deaths of the sheriffs.
The police officers, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is going to carry even a heavier sentence than just – they just murdered that one guy, barely go to jail.
Yeah,
if
right.
That maybe.
Right. So they all got death sentences. All three were executed by electric chair – on January 15th, 1943.
Wow, that's quick. That's a quick turnaround.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're like, get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
It was like almost immediately after
Straight
the trial
to the chair.
Was done.
Yeah.
Sue's execution actually made her the first woman ever to be executed in South Carolina's electric chair. She was like the first woman. And she was the first, I believe.
Women's rights.
Let me see. She was the she was also the first of the three to be executed. So.
Yep.
Just
equality
saying.
For all.
Yes. Now, many years after Sue, George, and Bagwell's executions, the guy who typically drives the bus to like transport prisoners came out and revealed that actually he had taken Strom Thurmond to the women's penitentiary.
Stop.
Where Sue was.
Stop.
Thurmond had said that he would personally take Sue to the execution, but actually the two had sex in the back of the car the entire time.
Yeah.
Which I just thought was like an interesting little.
Strom Thurmond.
He's like, all right, one last time. Let's go. Like, yo.
That'd be the last thing I'm
weird.
How about you break me out of here,
right,
fucker?
Right. Joe Frank also stood trial for his part in the murder, mainly for being an accessory. Mm-hmm. In 1943, Joe Frank was found guilty. He was also sentenced to death. Straight up.
Kill them all.
He was scheduled to be executed on January 23rd, 1944. But at the last minute, like, he had already had his last meal. He was pretty much, like, physically prepped to go. They had done all the prepping beforehand and was about to head to the chair. Joe Frank's sentence got commuted to life in prison.
That's fucking lucky, bro.
Yeah, for real. And he was eventually released on parole in 1960.
I mean,
yeah.
Did he really do any?
Right. I mean, yes and no. Yeah. I don't know. That's a tricky one. He did drive the getaway car.
Yeah.
And case the joint. But that is the story of David Timmerman and the mule and the Logues and the... I mean, it really is like this sort of twisty, windy...
Very Southern.
Very Southern.
Very Southern.
Yeah.
So this case is going to take us on a equally wild ride.
Okay.
But we're in modern times in California, and this is going to be about a slumlord landlord named Arthur Raffy Aslanian. I believe is how you say his last name.
Too real.
Mm-hmm.
Landlord's man.
Now, this is a pretty recent news story here, and it started about last February and is literally wrapping up in the month that we are recording this.
Oh, shit, really?
Of 2023. Really? So there's, you know, you can't go up on Wikipedia and fact check this shit. I'm telling you, this is like, I had to go on Facebook and get firsthand witness accounts of Facebook posts from his tenants.
Oh, God.
And... they started a group on Facebook to document the landlord's attempts to remove people from his property unlawfully. So this is a lot.
I mean, that's kind of smart, though.
This is
that's
first-hand really smart. Accounts, and this is news stories following along. So
okay.
I'm sure eventually we're going to see more information come out because this guy is the fucking sneakiest. So.
The pits, really.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Really. Aslanian was a landlord in North Hollywood. He owned several properties, including a 10-unit 1925 bungalow on Hartsook Street in North Hollywood. Now, starting just before the pandemic in January 2020, Aslanian started trying to get rid of his tenants in the building by slowly letting it decay and fall down. Classic. Classic slumlord move.
Yeah. Also illegal, but cool.
Well... L.A. has interesting laws about tenants and landlords.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, I should say in Illinois.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then after he couldn't get it to fall down, he attempted to basically evict people by starting to demolish the building while people were still living in it.
Well, that's definitely illegal.
How could someone do that? How? L.A. has always been the city that protects landlords.
That's fucked up.
You ever wonder why the homeless population exploded all of the sudden?
Yeah.
Well, tenant laws coupled with humongous inflation, landlords are getting a ton of protection.
Wow.
So if you decide to update your property, the city gives you tax incentives. And as long as you do it in a quote unquote safe manner, you can do this while tenants are still living on property. So you can effectively start to demolish a building while people are still living there if you claim that you are updating it.
Yeah, but it has to be done safely. So you can't just like...
What is safe?
I mean, not killing people.
Well, he didn't kill anyone.
Oh, my God.
So Aslanian started to do that. Now, below is a picture of the news story when they started, quote unquote, construction. And you can tell that there is an entire wall missing from the home.
Yeah.
Completely
so this
exposed.
Is before they started construction?
No, this is during the demolishing.
Oh,
the
during
building.
The demolishing. Okay.
That
okay.
woman lives where that door is open.
Wow,
that is
fucked up.
The front of her house.
Yeah, that's crazy, dude.
That is demolition.
There is no
not
wall
construction.
Yeah, that's wild.
It is just beadboard And the top where it starts to hit the eave of the roof is completely open.
Yeah.
With just studs.
That's fucking wild.
So on the night of June 13th, 2020, around 10 p.m., the landlord essentially began tearing down the building while people were living inside. And according to an interview with a tenant by Spectrum News, she said, I quote, I live in fear that I will wake up and I won't have any walls.
That's wild. You should not have to have that amount of stress in your home.
Now, this property was rent controlled and people had been living there for 10 plus years. So these tenants started to complain to the city and to try to see what legal actions they could take. Councilman Paul Krikorian issued a letter to the landlord and told Spectrum News that he is committed to protecting the rights of the tenants. So a lot of this is coming from Spectrum News, in case you didn't know.
Yeah.
Krikorian had a team of people put together a plan to work closely with the city's housing and community investment department. And they issued a stop work order to Aslan to prevent any more construction to the property. At this same time, an ordinance was being proposed, which would eventually pass a year later, that effectively would, quote unquote, protect tenants from landlords. And this was because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
That they decided to pass this law.
Which is insane that that's what it took. Because, frankly, the pandemic hit and the housing situation went from bad to worse.
Oh, yeah.
Because it really, like, made it more difficult for people to continue to stay in the housing they were in, afford to get different housing if they needed to. Mm-hmm. The availability of housing lowered.
Yeah.
Speaking as a person who was looking for an apartment during this horrible, horrible housing situation of, like,
yeah, there were three houses on our block that were up for sale and they instantaneously sold.
Yeah.
People moved in within a day of them selling.
That's crazy.
Which is not what
yeah.
happens on a normal time.
No. So it's not great.
No. So the ordinance was called the Tenant Anti-Harassment Ordinance, or Tahoe.
Nice. Nice.
It became a law August 6, 2021, and it sought to make abusive landlords subject to heavy fines and possible jail time. Its sponsors also intended to kind of help with getting civil lawsuits against abusive landlords going, because previous to this, it was next to impossible.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. So the ordinance contains what a lot of people are saying, big flaws.
Okay.
It's practically impossible for tenants to get lawyers to represent them in civil lawsuits because of the way that some of this is structured. The law does not guarantee lawyers reimbursements for legal fees, which is one of the biggest issues, because a lot of the people who are in these issues are people who live in rent-controlled properties who are close to the poverty line.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting.
So using these laws, the tenants of Aslian's block tried to band together to sue the landlord. And during this time, Aslian used several tactics to intimidate and try to force out these tenants from the property. Then something happened that was pretty bananas. And this is according to his tenants. It said, Aslan was under contract in February 2022 to sell a purported quote-unquote shovel-ready project for $13 million for this property that he was in the process of demolishing.
Okay.
So a shovel-ready project is, it's basically like a project plan that you are going to, like, turn this property into something amazing. And we see this a lot with, like, in Chicago, when we're talking about all of these abandoned buildings or all of these areas that are in, like, not great areas. Basically this kind of, like, gentrification sort of plan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he created this shovel-ready project for $13 million, which would double the amount of the worth of the property. So he paid $6 million for it and it would kind of double that property.
Gotcha.
So what happened was, while he was proposing this, two fires break out on the property.
Okay. I'm already very suspicious.
Whiffs of arson?
Yes. Yeah.
In January 2022, right before he's kind of, like, getting this stuff together, there's hearings to determine whether the bungalows would be removed from what's called a rent escrow account program.
Oh God, this is a lot of finance.
Yes. This is a city program to kind of compel compliance with housing codes and address, like, persistent habitual, like, safety issues.
Mm-hmm.
Tenants submitted evidence of ongoing issues and unresolved complaints in this, like, hearing to be like, this shit's fucked. Like, yeah. Don't put any money towards this.
Yeah.
This included broken and permanently open windows.
Yo.
So days after the hearing, it was like determined that they needed to kind of reschedule because of issues with some of the property. Like, they just had to go and investigate further.
Yeah.
So they were like, we're just going to kind of reschedule and we'll come back and visit it. And then a few days after that, it became February, and tenants awoke to discover evidence of attempts of arson. Now, you're like, what the fuck? There's pictures here of scorch marks along the building's foundation.
Okay.
They found a can of gasoline, a strangely triggered hot plate that was supposed to go off with this gasoline can.
Okay.
And security footage from someone's personal camera of two individuals entering and exiting the property.
Weird.
So I put in here the pictures that the tenants took to show that someone attempted to burn down this place.
Yeah.
So there's char marks along basically the basement area.
Yeah.
And a hot plate with a like literal tin can full of gasoline next to it.
Oh, is that what that is?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
So the hot plate was basically supposed to explode and then set the can off against the house.
Weird. Yes. All right.
So a few days after that, on February 8th, LA County Council voted to remove the building from the REAP program and return full control to Aslian so he could sell this shovel-ready proposal.
Okay.
Tenants received notice shortly after the approval of the REAP account closure, and they would have to resume paying full payments to the landlord.
Okay.
So they're now in a building that's partially demolished.
Yeah.
They have to go back to paying full rent. They're going to be, like, they know they're going to be kicked out of the home now eventually once all of everything is, like, done. But in the meantime, he's doing all these things to push them out. Then a month later after this, in the early morning of March 18th, 2022, now this is a quote from one of the tenants, quote, "My neighbors and I awoke to the LA Fire Department on the roof fighting flames of 20 feet high that were spreading rapidly through the shared attic crawl space towards everyone's units." This is the second fire attempt that was actually successful.
Oh my God.
Later, we learned that the LA Fire Department captain on the scene said that the fire would have easily consumed the building if not for their rapid intervention and suppression.
Wow.
And there's a picture in here of the entire fucking roof on fire with like 6 firefighters on top of it with axes.
Holy shit. So straight up just trying to burn the building down with people inside.
Burn the building down with his tenants inside.
That's nuts.
After the March 18th arson, tenants turned to the city of LA again filing complaints while the housing department, with the housing department for the fire damage, as well as all the calls and emails to this, you know, saying like, oh my God, like, he did this, then he did this, now he's setting the fucking building on fire. We have evidence of a previous attempt of arson a few weeks ago. Like, just really laying a fucking case out.
Yeah.
But nothing was done for these tenants. In fact, a property development plan sent to the city by Aslian for redeveloping that shovel-ready project was approved directly after this fire took place.
Fuck, okay.
By July of 2022, the tenants filed their lawsuit and took Aslian to court. Before the case got going too far, Aslian was arrested in September for not only hiring someone to burn down his properties, but in a separate case occurring at the exact same time, he also hired another person to hire someone else in a murder-for-hire plot. There's a lot of hiring.
Yeah.
We have arson and we have murder.
A
double down.
Okay. Okay, I'm just going to stick with this one.
Yes.
I'm going to trust it'll get me through it.
The arson and the tenant issues is what brought about the accidental discovery of him trying to murder someone.
Yeah. The arson, I get. I mean, that seemed pretty obvious that he was like, or somebody he hired was trying to burn the
just
fucking
a bad
building
dude
down.
Dude, all around.
The murder for hire. What's that all about?
Surprise. You're probably like, why is this in the murder for hire?
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. I was wondering where you were going with this.
Technically,
okay.
Hiring someone to commit arson is also murder for hire.
I mean,
but this is like a double.
Yes. Although part of me was like, well, maybe they were the tenants were trying to hire somebody to murder the fucking landlord.
So many plot twists.
So many plot twists.
According to prosecutors in his case, Aslian plotted with an employee of his, Cesar Rivera, to hire a hitman to kill an attorney.
Oh.
So in the court papers, because I think this person's identity was changed, he goes by the initials MY.
Okay.
So this attorney who had represented Aslian in a bankruptcy proceeding
okay.
a few years prior was the person that he was trying to find someone to murder. Okay. Aslian, so he had kind of been his attorney, and he owed him $261,000 in legal fees.
Aslian owed him?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Aslian refused to pay the attorney, saying, you didn't fucking do anything for me, you know? MY told him that he was going to sue him if he did not pay.
Okay.
So he started the proceedings to sue the man. The real estate developer also conspired to they call him a real estate developer. He's a slumlord.
Okay,
the man also conspired to kill a different person that in all of the court proceedings also had their name changed, which again makes me very curious as to why.
Yeah.
But their initials is S.E. So he tried to kill two people, M.Y. and S.E. The man, S.E., prevailed in a lawsuit against Aslian trying to take possession of a home that he owned. And so he was basically trying to get revenge on these two men that took money from him.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
So in the summer of 2022, Aslian approaches Rivera and states that he needs someone. Rivera contacted a gang member with an offer saying that Aslian would pay $20,000 per murder.
Wow.
Rivera used...
I love how worried he is about someone taking money from him, and he's like, but let me just drop,
$40,000 on this.
Wow.
Rivera used Facebook Messenger to deliver photos and information on the intended victims to the hitman.
Let me just say that if you're going to plot a murder, don't use fucking Facebook Messenger.
No, all of at that least can be try to get police.
At least try to get end-to-end encryption. Like,
yeah.
Not saying that you should do that. I'm not advocating for that. But listen.
Bro, everything is traceable. You but I'm just think. Saying.
Yeah, right. Don't do it on your phone. In fact, just don't do it.
So it didn't tell exactly in any of the information how law enforcement found out about the plot. But they did. And I'm going to say it's probably through a series of like snitches or street informants because they were dealing with gangs.
Yeah.
But they found out about the plot and warned the victims.
Oh,
and okay. Then while they were kind of getting this together, they brought in Rivera on September 7th. So Aslian also said that he was going to pay Cesar Rivera to find a separate individual for a few $100s to set the property on fire.
Okay.
So this person is going to get $500 to set the property on fire. And then we need a hitman to do two murders for $20,000 each.
$500 right? For arson?
For arson.
That's low. $20,000
for murder.
That's pretty low. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they come in with Cesar Rivera and they're like, listen, we got you on this arson. And also, what's this about all these murders?
Also, murders.
So he agreed to cooperate with the police. And they decided that they were going to set up basically like a bait and switch situation.
Okay.
They took the first victim, MY, and the feds staged a fake death photo of this man.
Is that what that is?
Yes.
Okay.
And sent it to Aslian from Cesar Rivera's account saying that, can you confirm this is him? We've taken care of it. And Aslian's response is, that's him.
That's a pretty good fake death photo. I'm not gonna lie.
Is it?
I mean, it's okay.
His throat was quote unquote slit. So it's the picture is of a man, a businessman yeah. in a suit, laying like one hand above his head on his side with like blood, fake blood across his neck.
Yeah.
It's very absurd.
It's not, I mean, it's not the worst. Let me say that. It might not be the best, but it's definitely not the worst I've seen.
It really is something.
As somebody who worked in a lot of haunted houses.
Yeah.
Convincing enough.
Convincing haunted house.
Yeah.
So according to federal prosecutors, the The Aslian guy told his assistant, apparently his assistant, was looking at these pictures to destroy the photographs and to never speak about the murder again. And he's like, you get rid of your evidence. You delete everything from my phone. Obviously, that's not how things work. And with a ton of incriminating evidence, Aslian was arrested on September 15th. Now, Aslian was scheduled to return to a court around October 6th for an arraignment hearing. Because obviously, hello, this motherfucker is guilty.
Right. Yeah.
So he was actually let out on $20,000 bond, and it was scheduled for October 25th for the arraignment in federal court. And Aslian's defense attorneys actually put together this like really intense multi-million dollar bond package meant to kind of like get him out of there so that he could kind of be comfortable. Yeah. Like, he's not going to run away. It's totally fine.
Right.
Which I would be like,
no, thank you. Yeah.
This prompted the U.S. Attorney's Office in Los Angeles to file the staged murder photos as the evidence to refuse the bail.
Okay.
Which I was like, how?
It's a stretch, but all right.
Yeah.
He had this guy murdered, but not really, because he's still alive.
You know, listen to all the stuff you wrote in here. It's like, he really wanted this guy to be dead. Yeah. He's like totally satisfied with these photos. So despite pleas, you know, he was released on $1.9 million bond. You know, and he said that the government failed, you know, to prove that he was a risk of flight or that mm-hmm. he wasn't in danger of the community because these were all like related to him crimes or whatever.
Okay.
So as of this month in July, just a week ago from this recording,
wow,
Arthur Rafi Aslian, aged 54, was found guilty of one count each of conspiracy and use of interstate commerce facilities in the commission of a murder for hire, as well as three arson-related counts.
Interesting. Okay.
The United States District Judge Jesus Bernal scheduled a sentencing hearing for October of this year, at which time Aslian will face a statutory maximum sentence of 10 years in federal prison for each murder for hire related count, and up to 20 years in a federal prison for each arson related count, and up to a mandatory minimum of 5 years in a federal prison for each arson count. So,
wow.
That's
definitely
a lot.
Looking at some prison time for sure.
Rivera pleaded guilty on March 27th of this year to one count of conspiracy and one count of use of interstate commerce facilities in the commission for a murder for hire. He faces up to 10 years in federal prison for each count, and his hearing is going to be in September. So okay. This will be ongoing until at least the end of this year. So that is a plot-twisting slumlord murder for hire arson case.
I'm curious what happened to his property holdings.
I mean,
if that reverted to somebody else
in
his family
know.
Or to a property management
he
company
didn't
or like
have a wife or kids.
Yeah.
I
would
know.
Be curious.
But
yeah.
I think during a case like this, I'm pretty sure they have that all assets get held anyway until the case is over. So at the very least that nothing's happening.
The tenants don't have to be stressed for a little while.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well,
so.
Except for all the damage that's already been done, but you know.
Gaping fucking holes. In their walls.
And the burning smell and you know,
fucking roof that was
God.
On fire. Yeah.
That's wild. That's wild,
that's
man.
That's all she wrote.
Yeah. Well, before you hire somebody to murder somebody else, first of all, don't. We'll always say that. But maybe check out this podcast.
My name is Hunter.
And I'm Haley, and we're your hosts of
Murder and Such, a podcast about true crime, serial killers, and other dark subject matter. Join us while we fill your ear holes with some crappy comedy and disgusting tales.
You can now find us on Spotify,
iTunes,
Stitcher,
Podbean,
and all of your podcatcher services. You can like us on Facebook, Instagram, and follow us on Twitter
at Murder and Such.
Hope to hear from you guys soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that has been our show, ladies, gents, and all those in the non-binary.
They's and thems.
Yes.
Z's and he's.
Z's and he's. If you enjoyed it, you want to hear more episodes like this, you can find more at badtastepodcast.com.
That's it.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it. Do you have anything you want to end the show on?
I mean, Don't commit crimes. That's all I got to say.
Stay safe, do drugs?
Yeah. I mean, drugs that aren't going to make you psychotic, but yeah.
On that note, our sound and editing is by Tiff Fullman. Our music is by Jason Zakshevsky, The Enigma. This has been the Bad Taste Crime Podcast. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Goodbye. It was as if a wave of evil washed over this town. We are all evil in some form or another. Psst. You need to hire someone. No. For murder. She didn't say that.
Just kidding. Bye.
No.